As you know, we are going to go through some of the verses in the Theragatha. Not everyone, of course. How many of you have never read the Theragatha? How many of you have? Okay. So this evening I'll just give a little background, and then tomorrow we will start on the actual verses and some commentary on the background to these verses. So basically, the Theragatha now has been translated by somebody called Charles Halisay. His book is called The Theragatha. And that follows the normal way that it's set up in the Pali, which means it starts with one verse and then goes to two verses, three verses. There's no order of subject or topic. It's just if one nun uttered one verse, that goes first, and the next nun that uttered two verses, that goes next. So it's in terms of the number of verses, not in terms of the seniority of the nun or of the topic which he was addressing. Then there's another book called First Buddhist Women by somebody called Susan Murcott, and she takes it and arranges it according to topic. So I have followed her example with this. I mean, to do with wives, to do with various topics of nuns, various sort of prostitutes and so forth. She's put it according to the various topics. She's grouped them together. So we're following that in this discourse that we're giving. So there's also Women in the Footsteps of the Buddha by Catherine Blackstone. So we'll talk a little later about the first person who translated this into English, who was Caroline Rice Davids. So basically, there are 73 poems, and which add up to 522 actual verses, and they're all in the Kudaka Nikaya. Is that how you pronounce it? Kudaka. The Kudaka Nikaya. The fascinating thing is that these verses, at the time of the Buddha, nothing was written down, right? Everything was orally transmitted and memorized. And people before writing had phenomenal memories. Nowadays, because we rely on books, we don't memorize the way we used to. I remember Gunaratana saying that when he was young, the Venerable Gunaratana, he said when he was young in Sri Lanka, he had the kind of memory that when he just read something, he would remember it. And he learned the whole canon by heart. And he recited it one time with a friend, kind of showing off, day and night for a week. And then he completely collapsed, blacked out. And when he came back, he had lost his whole memory of the whole thing. So that's what happens if you show off. But in the meantime, these monks had phenomenal memories. Even our nuns in our nunnery, they not only memorize the text that they're studying, but also the various commentaries that go with that text, so that during debate and so forth, they can bring back the apt quotation without having to look it up. They've got it all in their heads. So what is amazing is therefore that the canon was actually set down in about 30 BC, 29 BC, during the Fourth Council, which was held in Sri Lanka. So up until that time, from the time of the Buddha, is about 450 years. And for 450 years, some monks had memorized all these verses of the nuns and transmitted them. Which, if you think about it, well, if you know anything about monks, is quite amazing. That they did that and that they didn't drop out, you know, that they actually did pass on this tradition of memorizing these verses from the older nuns of the time of the Buddha. The Theravada are verses from nuns at the time of the Buddha. And we, when we go through it, you will see many of them recount their meeting with the Buddha and the enormous effect that had on their whole lives to do that. So, I mean, from that time on until it was actually written down centuries later, people had actually kept the memory and passed it on, which is really quite amazing. I mean, why they did that. But they did, so it's good. So, anyway, yeah. So, also, of course, there is the question of language, because nobody quite knows what language the Buddha spoke. He traveled mostly in the region of northeast India, which in those days was called Magadha. And exactly what language they spoke in that region, nobody quite knows. They think it was something, I mean, he spoke Magadhi, whatever that was, which was then translated into Pasachi, which then developed into Pali. Now, there were many monks, after the time of the Buddha, monks spread out throughout the regions of India, and they all spoke in their own dialect. The reason why Pali is extant to today is because the Emperor Ashoka, in the 3rd century BC, sent, he was in that region, and so he was due to the school of Buddhism which spoke Pali. There were 18 schools at that time, and they each had their own language and dialect, but the one which was where Ashoka had his, which is Patna, they were the particular tradition which spoke Pali. So he, in time, sent his son down to Sri Lanka. He sent monks all over. He was a great Buddhist emperor. I mean, he was. I don't know if any of you know anything about Ashoka, but he was quite amazing for his time. Anyway, he sent his son to Sri Lanka and converted the king there and all his court. And in time, he sent his daughter, Sanghamitta. And she also went there with her court lady. She was a nun. His son was a monk. And so then Buddhism was well established in Sri Lanka. And then from Sri Lanka, it spread to Burma and Thailand and all these other Southeast Asian countries. So the 4th Buddhist Council was held in Sri Lanka. And at that time, it was decided to commit the canon into Pali, the into Pali writing. So this was the first time it was actually written down. Up until then, it was just memorized and passed on. Mostly people would take a certain Nikaya and memorize that, you know, and then their students would likewise learn that Nikaya. Most people couldn't learn all the Nikayas, but they would have presumably part of their training was to memorize and pass on what they knew to their own students in time. So eventually it was put into a writing. And then in the 5th century AC, there's somebody called Dhammapala, and he wrote a commentary on the Theravada. He took all the previous commentaries which there had been, on because the verses often don't tell you who these women were. But there was an oral tradition behind the verses, saying who these people were. And so he collected all the various versions and put them together, and he wrote a commentary explaining who each of these nuns were, her background, and how therefore she came to recite these verses which we now have. So that's really very helpful because it illuminates the background from which these verses then were spoken. So a little anecdote is that in 1909, Caroline Rice Davids, who was the wife of Thomas Rice Davids, who was founded the Pali Text Society, right? That was the Rice Davids founded the Pali Text Society, and then Caroline translated this Theragat. She called it the, what did she call it? Yeah, the verses of the elder sisters or something like this. And then they wanted to publish it, but none of the publishing houses would touch it. They all said, what could be more boring than the, you know, poetry written by women 2,500 years ago? So they refused to touch it. They wouldn't even look at the manuscript. And so then she and her husband decided that, all right, so what? We'll publish it ourselves. And therefore, the Terigata was the first thing which was published by the Pali Text Society. And after that, of course, they subsequently published the whole of the Pali Canon. But it was because they wouldn't look at this book. That's why they started their own publishing company. And then again in 1971, it was translated by someone called K.R. Norman. So the question is, of course, that scholars ask, is did any individual nun actually write this verse? You know, where does it actually come from? I mean, did the nuns in fact write these verses? Who knows? Because, you know, they didn't sign it. In Asia, you don't put your name on a tanka. You know, you don't put your name to your poetry often. So many verses which came up, we don't know who wrote them and when and what. But nonetheless, so some people say, did all these 72, there are 72, 73 poems, did the nuns who wrote these poems actually exist? Maybe it was all just made up, right? But, 20 of these nuns who appear in this Terigata also appear in other parts of the Pali Canon. So, presumably, they genuinely did exist. Otherwise, why would they be named? And at the same time, 32 poems allude to the name of the nun, or they make a pun on her name. So they're clearly somebody was behind these verses, right? So what is amazing is that it's very rare in spiritual literature, and especially of that time, for women's voices to actually be heard. Who wrote the books? The monks, right? I mean, all of these texts were preserved by the monks and written down by the monks centuries later. So it's very, very unusual that they should have preserved 522 verses from the women. And I say, well done, monks, because they didn't need to. They could have dropped them. But they didn't. They carried them on through the centuries and finally even took the trouble to write them down and then in later centuries to write the stories behind how these verses came into being. So that was done by the monks and, you know, we can give them credit for that. We can give them credit for other things too. So, you know, normally women would have no outlets for expression. They weren't educated. And you never heard about them, what they thought, what they were feeling, or anything like this. So this is a very unusual work, because as we go through it, you'll see they often express their thoughts, their feelings, what they've been through, why they became nuns. And, of course, eventually their extraordinary inner joy at liberation. We'll go through that later, how this sense of tremendous relief that all that they've been through, and finally they got it. And, you know, there's the incredible happiness that the relief and the laying down of the burden which they expressed in their verses. They, all of them, were just so joyful, despite many of them having very, very sad lives prior to becoming nuns. So, the thing is, I mean, for example, when our nuns, I have a nunnery in India, and these girls are all from the Himalayan regions, and when they come, I ask them, why do you want to be a nun? And many of them say, I look at my mother, I look at my aunts and my older sisters, and I thought, I don't want that life. I want to do something more meaningful with my life, which will benefit myself and will also benefit others. And so I want to study and practice Dharma. So even today, that is the motivation for many girls to go forth. If they don't go forth, then they get married, and then, you know, they are spending all their life in these Himalayan regions doing field work, doing the cooking, doing the cleaning, having a baby every year, and then, you know, very often their husbands, drink away all their profits, and it's a very hard life for these women. Whereas becoming a nun, ironically, is a freedom, right? They can study, they can practice, they're with all the other girls, and they are free, even just in an ordinary life, apart from, you know, genuine realizations. It's much more freedom for them. So they, even our nuns express that joy in poems that they write also. I'm not saying they become arahats, but they nonetheless express also their feeling of freedom and joy in the life that they're leading. So, therefore, these nuns, they came together, they studied together, they practiced together, they taught each other. Their teachers were other nuns, which in that society was amazing. It has to be understood that in Indian society, the lawmaker Manu, he says, I've got it somewhere, I mean, he actually says, you know, that a woman, when she's young, is under her father, then she is under her husband, then as she gets older, under her sons. Women must never be independent. He says it. So therefore, in the family life, women were always under the rule of the male members of their family, along with their mothers-in-laws and sister-in-laws. So when they became nuns, it was a tremendous sense of freedom for them. They were able to teach each other, train each other, be with each other, and that whole pressure of being part of a very patriarchal society, they were free from that, more or less. So, therefore, many women wanted at one. Male authors, I don't really bother with that yet. There is also a Theragata, A Theragata is the verses of the monks. The verses of the monks, the Theragata and the Therigata. And so if you read the Theragata and the Therigata, you recognize there is a different tone to it. It isn't the same. And this also helps to convince us that these verses originally really were something like that, really was said by these women. Because the male version, it doesn't sound the same. It's a different tone. It's not better or worse, it's different. And so it's very unlikely that any monk would have known how to write verses in a tone which is much more familiar for the women, much more emotional than the Theragata. Much more interesting, actually. I don't want to go on and on, but the two main emphases which will come up again and again, the first is total renunciation. Some of these women came from very unfortunate backgrounds. Some of them came from very prosperous backgrounds. Some of them were princesses or from affluent families. Some of them were on the verge of being married. Some of them already had been married. They came from many different societies. But whether they had nothing or whether they were extremely affluent, the emphasis was on letting go. So they lived very, very basic lives. I mean, nowadays, when people become monks or nuns, they move into nice monasteries or even simple monasteries. At least they have shelter. If you want to get robes, you go off and you buy the material or someone offers it to you. But in these days, a lot of the Vinaya is taken up with how to get your robes made, because you couldn't just go to a shop and buy material. You had to often you had to ask somebody to weave it for you, or else there was the understanding you could get cloth which had been thrown out in a rag heap, or when bodies were cremated, then they were wrapped in a kind of cloth, and before the body was burned, you could take that cloth and then dye it the requisite color, cut it up into, and sew it back together again. That's why they wear kind of patched robes. And so a lot of them also were going around in very poor robes. I mean, nowadays, especially if you go to Theravadin countries or Mahayana countries, the monks at least are looking very, very splendid. But in the Buddha's time, they probably looked like some of those really, really scruffy sadhus in India, because they didn't bathe much and, they didn't shave very much probably, and they were Indians. And they must have looked a right lot, actually. I mean, wandering along. They were on the road, and their alms bowls were often patched because they broke. They were made of clay and then they broke, and then they had to patch them again. I mean, it has a number of patches before you're allowed to get a new alms bowl. All these amenities were very difficult to get. And so it's not like nowadays where people live in nice monasteries and nunneries and they're taken care of. In those days, they were on the road. And in the beginning, there were no monasteries. There was nothing. They were sleeping in the forests under trees. This was before the nuns' order was created. But, I mean, in the early days, they lived very, very austere lives. It was still considered to be a middle way, because in India, as I'm sure you know, some sects go in for extreme austerity, standing for years on one leg or under the hot sun with fires all around and this type of thing. I mean, a tremendous amount of overdone austerity. And the Buddha himself, of course, had tried fasting extremely until he finally collapsed. So compared with that, the merely going on alms round and eating once a day was considered almost luxurious. And so it was therefore regarded as a middle way between extremes. But from our side, it looks like really very, very hard, their lives. So the first emphasis is on leaving home for homelessness, whether one was in solitude, as some of the monks were, wandering by themselves, or in a community. They had to leave everything behind. Their family, their jobs, their security, and of course all their wealth. They went forth with nothing. And the point is that even today, for a woman to renounce her duties to society was regarded as very threatening. Even today in India, although there are, you know, many swamis and sadhus and, you know, many ashrams with swamis and so forth, there are not many swamini. There are not many female swamis. It's still regarded as being very threatening to the social setup that a girl would renounce belonging to a man and renounce the opportunity to have children, especially sons, and that she would actually choose to live without male protectionship with other females, even today, is regarded as very suspicious. And so as a result, the women who went forth were often looked down on. And this is true also in Buddhist countries. I mean, the nuns always struggle compared with the monks in many Buddhist countries, especially in Theravadin Buddhist countries, for various reasons. One, because they have they don't have full ordination anymore, but also because as women who have left society, they are not celebrated in the way that a male would be. I mean, in Theravadin countries and other Buddhist countries, monks are very highly esteemed. Even if they are only doing a temporary ordination, they're very highly esteemed compared with the nuns who are probably in there for life, are leading much more austere lives, and yet are really almost looked down on. I mean, if your son becomes a monk, then everybody congratulates you. If your daughter becomes a nun, oh, what was wrong? Because it's regarded that a girl would become a nun as the last resort. You know, maybe she's a widow, maybe she has something wrong with her, maybe something's gone wrong. Then, as you know, not knowing what to do, she becomes a nun, which is ridiculous because these women are extraordinarily devoted, extraordinarily often very intelligent, very pure lives, and really, really exemplary in their conduct. But nonetheless, it's still regarded as threatening that a woman would actually turn her back on the household life. Believe me. So therefore, they were also often, nuns were grouped with loose women who lived on the edges of society, like prostitutes and dancers and people like that. And the law actually said, was if something damage was done to a householder, a woman householder, the punishment was much more severe for the perpetrator than if it was done for a prostitute or a dancer or a nun. They were regarded as being outside society. So this, what I'm saying is that these women really gave something up, right? Because they didn't get much respect. So therefore the emphasis has always been on overcoming desire and pulling out our attachment and greed by the roots. Along with that, therefore, it came the meditations on seeing the body as impure. You know, I mean, we are also, especially women, are very attached to their physical appearance and often regard the fact of how they are looking as being a test for whether people will like them or not. You know, they go into this much later in great detail. But it's very true up until the present day. It's not just in India, you know, 2,500 years ago, that women were often judged by their beauty and therefore were always very, very attached to their looks and wanting to stay youthful and attractive, because otherwise they wouldn't be wanted. And so, therefore, these nuns very much, especially some of them, they had been courtesans or very beautiful, and everybody had always admired their looks. And so they very much emphasized how, indeed, beauty is only skin deep. Take the skin off and what have you got? So they go into this in some detail, some nice gory detail. I thought this is perfect for California. So the emphasis is on overcoming desire, the loathsomeness of the body, and always they are looking at their own body. It's very interesting that in later texts written by monks, the meditations on the unpleasant aspects of the body is directed at a female. They visualize her becoming, you know, and all the, you know, her kidneys and lungs and intestines and heart and so forth. Imagine peeling off the skin and seeing her, or her becoming older and older and turning into a skeleton. They don't see themselves. Even though the Buddha himself said that, you know, a monk should see himself from the top of the head to the soles of the feet. But later on, by the time you get to Nagarjuna, for example, in the first century, it's not the monk. The monk's all nice and clean and pure. It's her. She's the problem. But the nuns didn't do that. The nuns always looked into themselves and dealt with their own attachment to their beauty. So therefore, this is always the basic idea is that desire is overcome, the work is done, rebirth is ended, darkness torn, the fetters are cut, peace is attained. So this sense of freedom, of relief in comes again and again in all these verses, that the burden is laid down. And so this they have attained through their arahatship. All these nuns became arahati. Every single one realized nirvana. In those days, they did. So they got it through renunciation, through perfect sila, discipline, through samadhi or meditation, and through wisdom. So therefore, this life of simplicity and contentment with little, the middle way between extreme asceticism and self-indulgence, it was just a freedom and liberation which completely transcends the experience of ordinary life. And so each one of these verses is a paean of joy at the end of being released from endless rebirth and redeath in samsara, that now finally they had accomplished the task and that the work was now done. So this is how they felt about their lives. All their lives, no matter how difficult they were, had ended in this total openness of transcending their ordinary conceptual thinking and realizing nirvana face to face. So tomorrow we will start with, of course, the great Mahaprajapati Gautami, who was the Buddha's aunt and foster mother, stepmother, and was, of course, the first Buddhist nun. We have her here behind us. Somebody's depiction. Of course, we don't exactly know how she was, but she was elderly, that we do know. And anyway, because of her and her persistence, with the help of Ananda, we are here today. Without her, it probably would never have happened. So we are very grateful to Mahaprajapati, and we will deal with her story tomorrow. Okay?
Thank you. And we were thinking to have a short sit before ending tonight. So maybe for about 20 minutes or so.
Could just say a couple of words.
Do you know?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.